From Texas Motor Speedway, this is No Limits Nation. Here's your host, the voice of Texas Motor Speedway, Rich Phillips.
Thanks for joining me here for another edition of No Limits Nation, presented by Ashley Home Store. I'm Rich Phillips, and if you don't subscribe already, please subscribe to our twice-a-week podcast every Tuesday. I try to recap racing for you, and actually I did this Tuesday, and I will this coming Tuesday, recapping e-racing for you. And on Thursdays, a lot of times we look ahead to racing. This week, though, we're going to do this a bit more here. During our downtime together, we're going to look back at some classic races at Texas Motor Speedway. And the one we'll talk about on today's show will be the first race weekend in 1997 at Texas Motor Speedway. And in just a moment, we're going to first have talked to Texas Motor Speedway President Eddie Gossage about his memories of that first race. It was back in April of 1997. I'll do a recap of that race. We're going to hear some of the post-race driver comments as well from the CBS television broadcast. And if you haven't seen it or you're looking for some racing to fill your downtime, go find it on YouTube. That's what I did this week. You can watch the entire Interstate Batteries 500 from 1997 on YouTube. The biggest update in the racing world came out on Thursday midday, and that is the postponement of the Indy 500 this year due to the coronavirus. This will now not be run until August 23rd. And also, the GMR Grand Prix of Indy that was scheduled to be run May 9th, it's being pushed back, and we're going to have a NASCAR IndyCar doubleheader on July 4th weekend. I'll have more details on that later in news from the garage. So with those two postponements from IndyCar, our next racing in IndyCar is going to be the week before our Texas race, Saturday and Sunday, May 30th and 31st, the dual races in the streets of Detroit. That's next up for IndyCar. The week after, 10 weeks from now, is when the Genesis 600 is slated for Saturday night, June 6th at Texas Motor Speedway. Our next NASCAR race is still slated as being the Cup Series event, the Blue Emu Maximum Pain Relief 500 at Martinsville on Saturday, May 9th. But I think as we all have figured out by now, stay tuned. We'll have to wait and see where scheduling will go here for NASCAR and for all of sports, and really for all of us in general, too. I know for our work here at Texas Motor Speedway and our Speedway Motorsports family, we've been home now for this, our second week working out of our homes, and we've got three more weeks of it, we were informed by our company. So I'm sure many of you are in the same boat. So we'll keep working away here at the house. I'll have a couple of podcasts a week for you here on No Limits Nation, presented by Ashley Homeshore, and invite you to go ahead and subscribe, and that way you'll get the shows when they are posted, and you can have at least a little bit of an escape from the corona news, as we call it, at my house. So we are going to start looking back at some classic races here on our Thursday shows on No Limits Nation. And this week, I thought what better time to start than with the first race, the first Cup Series race, I should point out, run at Texas Motor Speedway. April 6th of 1997 was when that first race was run, the Interstate Batteries 500. And joining me to talk about it is the president and general manager of Texas Motor Speedway, Eddie Gossage. Eddie and I are practicing social distancing as we're each working at our homes right now. And first off, Eddie, before we get to the race, these are certainly strange times that we are in, quite strange to have our track quiet this week. We should be busy getting ready for a race this week.
Well, it's strange times for everybody, and obviously not appropriate that we gather in any kind of group, particularly one as big as a NASCAR Cup Series race at Texas Motor Speedway. So that race will be rescheduled. When, we don't know. As soon as we know, believe me, we'll pass it along. But I think we're all looking for guidance, and for that matter, I think all of us are just learning every day about what lies ahead of us. And until we have some clarity, there's no reason to say this date or that date, because it really doesn't matter until we get a little more, a little further down the road and know where we're headed with this whole thing. So I just urge everybody to be safe and tune in and watch the iRace on Fox this Sunday at, I want to say, 12 noon.
Yes, sir.
On Central Time. And you'll see not only a bunch of the guys you expect to see, like Jimmy Johnson and Denny Hamlin and Joey Logano, and but you'll also see NASCAR Hall of Famer Bobby Labonte. You'll see Dale Jr. you're going to see a lot of guys having a lot of fun, and the race is pretty darn good. So tune in Sunday, and it'll be just like you're at Texas Motor Speedway.
Hey, you know, the thing that really struck me about the first one last week and what we're going to see this week, too, is not a lot of arm twisting going on to get drivers to participate in this. They might be a little bit stir crazy as part of the reason, but these guys are ready to do it.
Well, I'll be honest. I've always thought race car drivers were grossly overpaid because they would do it for free, and they're proving that. So, yeah, it's I think it's just a good diversion for them and for us as well. So, you know, it'll be a lot of fun to watch the O'Reilly Auto Parts 125 Sunday on Fox.
Part of our diversion here on No Limits Nation during this time is we're looking back at some of the more historical races that we've had here at Texas Motor Speedway, and I couldn't think of a better way to start off, Eddie, than with race number one, 23 years ago when racing started at Texas Motor Speedway.
Oh, man.
Give me your top memory from the 1997 Interstate Batteries 500.
Well, first of all, I've got to tell you that when folks come up to me and talk about being at that first race, and I always tell them, well, you know, there you go. You're ruining thousands and thousands of dollars worth of therapy that I've gone through since that race, because it was just a total mess from our side, from my side. And, you know, and I say that jokingly because, you know, the place was packed. I always said a success, but certainly not an artistic success. But I guess the memory that I have is that the place was packed to the rafters. And despite the conditions where it had rained on Thursday and Friday, like it did in the Bible as Noah was finishing up the ark. So, you know, our parking lots weren't ready, and the rain just made them impossible to use. So overnight on Friday, we rented every bus we could get our hands on from cities, from schools, from churches. From if you had a bus, we'd rent it from you, and we set up park and ride locations around the area, and stunningly got everybody in and got everybody out. But it wasn't pretty, and I would never ever want us to have to go through that again. And of course, since we've dressed up the parking lots, adjusted them you know, with equipment to drain sheet drain off, and also every acre of grass you see out at the speedway is actually a gravel parking lot. We went back in 1 acre at a time, wet down an acre, rolled gravel throughout it. And when I say gravel, I don't mean the small gravel. It's big aggregate rock, and then rolled over it. So it kind of mushed it down in the ground so that the grass could grow back over it. But we've had races where we've had rain, and people don't get stuck. We don't have those issues. So we've been able to address it, but that first race, I think just getting the people in and out was in and of itself just a miracle. And particularly considering that it was about 190,000 people. So, you know, it's we didn't have a soft opening by any stretch.
No. Through the miracle of YouTube, I got to go back and watch the race this week. And one of the things I noticed when you talk about the parking on some of the overhead shots on CBS, Allison, which is the main road that comes right into the middle of the speedway from 114, outside the track, on both sides there were cars parked on Allison. The inner ring road that's right up close to the speedway, on both sides there were cars parked there. It looked like it was an unbelievable scramble to find some place, anything that was dry to park a car on.
Well, one of the things we did do, we were able to get our hands on some aggregate, and every road that was paved, we went in and added shoulders so that people would have some place to park. But there, you know, you'd see them on the side of the road, then you would see literally 200 acres of nobody,
right?
You know, with a crowd of 190,000, you're going to need to be able to park 65,000 cars. And, you know, there weren't 10,000 cars parked on the property. So it was a colossal nightmare and a colossal miracle that we pulled it off. It really is.
Was it, didn't I remember, too, that 156 over on the west side of the Speedway was turned into a parking lot, too, the highway?
No, actually, it was Highway 170, okay. Which is south of the Speedway at the really the south end of Alliance Airport. And were it not for, you know, a TxDOT official going above and beyond his authority, and I can say it now because the gentleman has passed away, so he's not going to get in any trouble, obviously, but I will never forget him. He said, we'll just close 170 and you can use it as a park and ride. And so, and 170 today is the home of giant, huge, warehouse and distribution centers and thing. And, I believe there's a couple of plants along through there, and Amazon plant is, warehouses there. But back then there weren't very many, businesses located along there. So they allowed us to park along our fans to park on either side of the road, and down the middle, we ran buses and would pick you up and drop you off after it was over, and on Highway 170. And to do that requires, it may require legislative approval. so it was way above and beyond his authority, but had he not offered that up, we could not have held the race. So, I will never forget that man for jumping out there and saving our necks.
I can tell you, I of course didn't work at the track in 97. I worked at a local sports radio station, The Ticket, at the time. But I was out there on Friday when everything was going down, and there was a fairly hastily called press conference to describe all the plans to try to make up for the parking. And I'm going to tell you, in the 23 years now that I've known you, Eddie, that might be the most rattled I'd ever seen you be that day.
Well, I had been up all night long reading buses. And so, you know, it was, and I'll be honest, I was really surprised at the almost militant approach by some of the media folks. You didn't have a plan? You didn't have a backup plan? Well, no, there is no backup plan to because nothing like this had ever happened before. So, it was a handful trying to explain what I think is, you know, what I thought then and what I think looking back now is a fairly simple answer to the question. But they were really a handful. That was one of the toughest press conferences ever. So I probably didn't handle it as well as I should. And I, you know, I'm 23 years older and more mature today. I think I would have handled it differently, perhaps. You know, I did my best to explain things over and over and over again. So one of those things, live and learn.
Oh, of course, racing actually started on Saturday with the NASCAR Xfinity Series running. I guess it was the NASCAR Busch Series in those days.
Yeah, the Busch Series.
Had to be good to see a big name like Mark Martin go to victory lane in your first race you had on the track.
Well, you know, Mark was the first driver to run competitive laps on the track, and Mark's a driver that at one time I was his PR guy, and so it was really good to have a good friend to run on the track, and you know, he told me a lot about the experience he had and what he felt. And you know, the problem is that everybody saw Charlotte Motor Speedway. The garages look just like Charlotte Motor Speedway, and you pull up on pit road and it looks like you're at Charlotte Motor Speedway, and you go, you know, the racetrack from itself looks like Charlotte Motor Speedway. And Mark was telling me this. He said, you go down pit road and it's just like Charlotte Motor Speedway, and you run around the apron and turns one and two and come up on the track on the back straight away, and it looks like Charlotte Motor Speedway. And you go, you know, you're still gaining speed through turns three and four and come down the front straight away, and it seems like, looks like Charlotte Motor Speedway. And you're full speed going into turn one and it's not Charlotte Motor Speedway. So he said, you know, we're all used to running Charlotte. That's a track that we've run forever and ever and ever. And he said, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got your hands full because the length of the track is the same, but the straightaways are shorter. The turns are sharper. The geometry is different in the turns. But it didn't, you know, to the naked eye, for the drivers, it was a different racetrack, and so it was difficult for them to figure out, and then you had brand new pavement, obviously, and race cars don't like brand new pavement. So it was, you know, it was, Mark told me a lot about the track from a test that he had, the initial test. And so it didn't surprise me that a guy that was so good at adapting to racetracks, new racetracks, was the guy to win that first race, the Busch race, the Xfinity race on Saturday. Not surprised at all.
Then you get to Cup Day on Sunday. The green flag is dropped on the Interstate Batteries 500. The field sails off into turn one, and about half of them don't make it to turn two.
Yeah, and, you know, Darrell Waltrip is a dear, close friend as well, and I've said it a million times to him. You don't go dive down to the bottom of the turn if there's a car underneath you. And, you know, Darrell just starts screaming something about remember the Alamo, and I don't know what he's trying to say with that, but, you know, I still say to this day, say Darrell started a huge crash because he was, you know, the fast way around is at the bottom of the track and on new pavement, and he thought he had a hole that was big enough to get in line down there, and he didn't, and it caused a heck of a crash, and so many of your top names had their day ruined. And, you know, we didn't even get in, like you said, we didn't get past the first turn. And so it was just heartbreaking because I knew what was going to be said, you know, because no race car driver ever has been responsible for a crash. It's always something else. And I knew the easy thing to blame was the racetrack. And of course, that's what happened. So you hate to see that. But that was the story that day.
What else sticks out to you about that first race with Jeff Burton getting his first career win that afternoon?
Well, you know, at the time, I knew Jeff. I'll tell you a funny story. I knew Jeff and Ward, but I didn't know them well. Ward Burton is his brother. They both were at the Cup level. And so Jeff wins his first race, and I'm presenting a trophy for the first time. And I had not given it any thought because I had expected Bruton Smith, the owner of the Speedway, to present it. And he said, I'm not presenting the trophy here. You present the trophy here. This is, you know, 10 minutes before Victory Lane. So I've got to get to Victory Lane. And so I'm standing there. I don't often get to see much, if any, of the race. And I didn't know who won. Jeff or Ward. Ward or Jeff. And so I'm standing there. And he's won his first Cup race ever. And they hand me the microphone, and I've got the trophy, and I start talking, and I start asking myself in my head, which Burton is this? And I know that no matter what I say, it's going to be the other Burton. I got a 50-50 shot, and I know I'm going to be wrong. And so I just am talking and talking, and I'm looking all over his uniform, trying to find his name on his uniform somewhere. And he finally realized that I was just – talking away, stretching, and my eyes were all over the place. And he dipped his shoulder so I could read his name off the roof of the car. And so otherwise I would have presented the trophy to Ward Burton probably. So that was one of those things I've learned to know more and do better in the future. So, but that was one of those things, and Jeff and I have laughed about it ever since.
What do you think that the track and the staff handled the best during that first event that weekend?
Not a thing. We didn't handle, I can't think of a single thing that we handled the best. You know, it just, when I came here to Texas, and it was really about 25 years ago, to, you know, start from scratch to buy up pieces of that property and eventually build the place, I was allowed to bring two people with me from Charlotte, one that had a lot of experience and the other that had worked as an intern for me in Charlotte. And that was it. Nobody else on the staff had any experience in staging a NASCAR race. A lot of them had come from other sports. I hired particularly from the Texas Rangers staff. Back then, Tom Schieffer ran the Texas Rangers, and they were an exceptionally well-trained, experienced staff, and they were great. But doing a ball game for 40,000 people in an auto race where you've got 40,000 people camping and you've got, you know, 190,000 or so people coming, somewhere between those numbers, you go from nothing to it to virtually impossible to do. And so the staff was green, green, green. And it was really, one of those products of a variety of things. One of them being a green staff. The other one being, when I go to a ball game at the American Airlines Center or at Cowboys Stadium or the Rangers Stadium, I know my secret way to get there, what works best for me from where I live and all like that. And I think everybody pretty much has those, they have their routes down and know where they're going to park so they can get in and out quickly. And well, nobody has that when you have a brand new venue. So for everybody, it was brand new, including the police that were handling the traffic. So it was just in every respect, just a new thing. And we had to go through some teething pains to get to where we are today, where we can get a crowd in and out in no time at all. But I think still 23 years later, if you ask people, they'll tell you traffic around there is horrible. It's not. It's, the roads have improved so much. The way to get in and out everybody's got their way in and out down. It's a piece of cake today, but I think we still suffer from that first weekend, 23 years later.
Yeah, I was going to say, we barely had roads out there, it seemed like, in 97. It was still right. A country highway at 114, a two-lane country road that the Speedway was on.
It was. And, what we saw when we found the piece of property, Bruton Smith and I were together and flew over it in a helicopter and both looked at each other and said, that's it. It's because we had Highway 156 on the west and 114 on the south and I-35 on the east. And except for I-35, everything else was two-lane traffic. And today, everything is, four lanes, six lanes. There's a whole new exit on I-35 that we built out of our own pockets. Dale Earnhardt Way is we're served by two on-off ramps at I-35. So, it as it should, it has matured and is so much better today. But boy, it was just a mess back then.
When new venues are open, I know there's always that last minute scramble to finish up construction on this part or that part. Were there any last minute projects you can recall that maybe did not get finished in time for race day?
Well, clearly the parking lots, but beyond that, I can tell you that there were some plumbing issues. Even though we had done a grand flush where you flush every toilet in the place at once to make sure everything works right. But, when you get everything up and running at capacity, particularly for something new, you're going to have problems. And we had some sewage problems, to be perfectly honest. And it was just a mess because, the plumbers had to get to it. And there wasn't just one issue. There was problems here, there, and everywhere. And so it was a deal where they were running and chasing and trying to fix everything. And it was – that one stands out of my mind simply because I can't imagine, but some fans had pipes leaking on them from above. So – that's not very pleasant.
Well, it's gotten smoother since then. I wish we were racing this week, Eddie, and maybe we'll get to see each other again sometime too. We're in the remote working environment that most people are at this time.
We are, and it breaks my heart that we're not racing this weekend because race week is so much fun for me. I mean, that's the whole point of working at the Speedway is putting on these big events and enjoying, presenting them to the public. But there's a good reason why we can't do that right now. We'll do it hopefully soon. And, I just appreciate the fans, particularly the fans I talk to, and I see them daily that have been at every race since that very first one. I don't know that I would have been back. So, thank God for the fans and their patience. And then and now and that's the only reason we work is for the fans.
Eddie, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
Hope to see you soon, Rich.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
I'm Kevin Harvick, and this is No Limits Nation.
That was Eddie Gossage, of course, our president and general manager at Texas Motor Speedway. Great to hear some of his memories, sorry to ruin all of his therapy that he had to try to forget the nightmare that went on that first race weekend at Texas Motor Speedway. I thought we'd do a little bit of a brief recap of the Interstate Batteries 500 from April 6, 1997. Like I said, you can go on YouTube. You can find this entire race and watch it for yourself. The version I saw, a little bit suspect in the quality. Of course, it's also low def. I call it LD or ULD, ultra low def. Definitely not high def at that time in 97. The announce crew, one I remember quite well, with the great Ken Squire, Ned Jarrett, and Buddy Baker, the late Buddy Baker, as the analyst on the broadcast with him. Mike Joy, who we had on Tuesday's edition of No Limits Nation, the current lap-by-lap announcer on Fox, he's one of the pit reporters on CBS. It was a CBS broadcast, by the way, there in 1997. I was really intrigued as I was reading up some more on this. That was still back in the day when tracks cut their own TV deals. This is before Fox was involved, before NASCAR started managing all the TV deals, and therefore not every race was televised, or at least televised live. And I saw one story where somebody who wrote a piece about this race said he didn't get to watch the race until that night because his CBS affiliate didn't pick it up live. They ran it on tape delay. I mean, that's only 23 years ago that things were that much different. As I noted with Eddie, the drop of the green flag, and we had a mess right away. They didn't make it through turn one before Darrell Waltrip touches off a 13-car accident in that first turn. He had tried to cut down to the inside line. I believe it was Dale Earnhardt who was there that he got a little contact from. I was struck by the fact when I looked at the finishing order on the race report, there were 9 cars who failed to qualify for this race. And this is in the day of the 43-car field. 52 cars entered into the race. And a lot of them, the ones that didn't qualify, were just because of where they were in points. This was no qualifying on that weekend because of rain, so they set the field on points. Watching some of the shots, and of course, look, for 6 years I've been going to the Speedway every day to work there, but I've gone there many, many years, many, many times over the 20-plus years it's been open. It was strange to see Turn 1 did not have the Speedway Club. That's where our offices are, where we work full-time at the Speedway. Lone Star Tower, the offices and the condos outside of Turn 2, it was under construction, the early stages of construction for that. Was really interested at the fact that aerodynamics weren't the same. The cars weren't the same. You know, the cars, I admit, they look pretty cool. You had the Ford Thunderbird. It was the last year Ford ran the Thunderbird. Chevy was running the Monte Carlo. We didn't have Dodge. We didn't have Toyota. We had Pontiac. They ran the Grand Prix. And there was a real manufacturer war going on. The cars looked much more. I mean, you could look at the front of the car, especially. You could tell what make it was just by the nose, because the car, the whole front of the car looked totally different. Much more like the production line car. Much more of a stock car, if you will. And there was the big part of the manufacturer war was over aerodynamics, because it wasn't like today's cars in NASCAR where, while, yeah, the nose has a little different styling to show you it's a Toyota, a Ford, or a Chevy, they're all the same aerodynamically. There was always one team, one manufacturer claiming that another manufacturer had an aero advantage. They regularly made changes to the rear spoiler height and to the nose. I think they had just changed the spoiler height coming into Texas for one of the manufacturers. It's something I'd forgotten about that went on before they went to the common template for all the cars. When I first started watching pit stops during this race, They had a stopwatch on up in the corner there for Ernie Irvin's pit stop, and it was 19 and a half seconds long. And I was like, holy cow, most truck teams are better than that. And the announcers seemed impressed with that pit stop time, so I continued to pay attention to that throughout the race. And 20 seconds was a normal pit stop time back in the late 90s. I'm not sure what was so much different about it. You know, they were gassing the car with an extra man because they had the catch can man for the overflow. I guess the air wrenches weren't nearly as good then as they are now. And I think also the crews weren't as highly trained as they are now. Those guys probably had other jobs. But, man, 20-second pit stops were kind of the order of the day. So Jeff Gordon, who took forever, it seemed, to win at Texas, just didn't have much success. But this kind of showed to me what I knew about Gordon over the years at Texas. He ran good there. He just didn't get a lot of good finishes there. He was leading a lot in the early part of the race, and then he spins out Jimmy Spencer on lap 98. Spencer was racing for his life, trying not to go a lap down. Kind of looked like Spencer may have turned down in front of Gordon. Gordon pretty much was below the white line going into turns one and two when that happened. And then under caution, man, they had a tough couple of interviews under caution. First, they interviewed Joe Gibbs, who was already a car owner at this point, and it turns out that was the day that his former boss, Redskins owner Jack Kent Cook, had passed away. Talked to him about that. And then they had an interview on the phone during that caution with Rick Hendrick, who was undergoing cancer treatment. And actually, I think they said he was really on radio at the time with him, but he was away from the track undergoing treatment for cancer there in April of 1997. Lap 143, hated to see Mark Martin blow up while leading the race. He had won the Xfinity race the day before the Coca-Cola 300 on Saturday. And at this point, you start to see something that I had forgotten about, too. There's no lucky dog. They used to race back to the start-finish line when a caution came out. And we saw why they quit doing this, although it took a number of years before they quit doing this. On lap 163, Sterling Marlin hits the outside wall coming off turn four and may have been putting some fluid on the track. And then we wind up with nine cars wrecking by the time this is over. Jeff Gordon wrecks out of the race. Many of these wrecks occur as drivers are coming off four, trying to race back to the line. It included Rusty Wallace and Ernie Irvin. Irvin plowing into the back of Greg Sachs as he was coming to the line, and then Gordon plowed into him. And again, it's caution, but they're all racing to the start-finish line because you could pass a guy and, you know, hey, you might be behind your teammate a lap down who's the leader. He's going to slow up and let you go by to get your lap back. Well, they kept doing this until 2003 when they did away with racing back to the line, and that's when they do like they do now. They freeze the field, and then they instituted the lucky dog. The first car one lap down gets his lap back because it still gave you the benefit that you quite often would see when they raced back to the line. But, man, I forgot how they used to do that and how at times it was really, really unsafe when they were racing back to the line, and we saw that there after that Sterling Marlin incident. Dick Trickle surprisingly ran top 10 for a while. He finished up 23rd, and I love the note they had on him during the race that Trickle crew chiefed for himself. He fired his crew chief earlier in the week, and he actually went for 3 weeks as his own crew chief before he hired somebody else, or his team hired somebody else to be the crew chief for the legendary Dick Trickle. Joe Nemechek and Johnny Benson both had a huge wreck on lap 259. Benson spun in front of most of the field on the speedy dry off of a restart, and then Nemechek spun out behind him and slammed into him. They went head-to-head, nose-to-nose on the inside apron on the backstretch. Both looked like they were slightly injured. And this is one of those things, too, where it reminded you the other thing they did because of the way they did cautions and not freezing the field. So whoever the pace car came out in front of, that first car behind him was the first car behind him. But sometimes there were lap down cars that were in front of the leader. You could have as many as 10 lap down cars directly behind the pace car that would be in front of the leader. They didn't let you get your lap back that way, get the wave around. And so you would have lap cars that would be starting at the front. Benson was one of those in this situation. On lap 278, Jeff Burton noses the back of Todd Bodine exiting turn two. First, I thought it looked like he just punted him to the wall, and that's how Burton got the lead. Bodine, no, actually, you saw in the replay, little air was taken off the back of his car. He had a wiggle that got him loose and then was nudged by Burton. Bodine, by the way, was driving the 25 in place of Ricky Craven, who'd suffered a nasty crash on Thursday in the first practice session. After that wreck with Bodine, they go under caution. They come back for a restart. Not on TV. CBS missed the restart. They came back and the race had been going for a lap. Doesn't happen today. Restarts don't happen until TV is back. It was such a different world. Burton out front there. He winds up driving away down the stretch. He leads the last 53 laps for his first career win in 96 career starts. He led 60 laps overall on the afternoon in his first career win. And the post-race interview, he drives into victory lane, and Mike Joy is there to do the interview, and he doesn't even get out of the car to do the interview.
He called his crew chief, Ken, on the cool-off lap and said, "Where do I go?" Buddy Barrett says, "Just come on in, I'll show you." Hey, guys, Tony, give me a little room here. Jeff Burton, finally, victory lane, undefeated in Texas. How's it feel?
Hell, I don't know. Feels pretty good. This team has been working really hard. We've lost more than we won, that's for sure. We've given a few away. We didn't give this one away.
Buddy Parrott backed you down those last 50 laps, and then you took control of the race pace back with about 10 to go. Don't give me lap times, just give me the interval. Let me know what I got.
Well, it really didn't matter how fast we could run. It only mattered where the other guys were, and it was a matter of just being patient and, you know, not screwing up. Sometimes all you can do is mess up.
So there's Jeff Burton, sounding very young, by the way, at the time. His wife was there. Boy, we have seen her a lot lately, at least I have now, of her nervous times watching somebody go on to their first win there with Jeff Burton. She was sitting on the pit box as he rolled to his first win in 1997, and just a few weeks ago when their son Harrison earned his first NASCAR Xfinity Series win at Auto Club Speedway, and her nervous time on the pit box. He beat Dale Jarrett. He led 42 laps. He stayed as the points leader after this race, and Dick Bergeron caught up with him.
Dale Jarrett here at the gas pumps. You ought to be smiling, my friend. You're lucky to finish this thing with all the troubles that you had. How'd you do it?
I don't know, just good Lord was with us. We had a lot of problems here today, and you know, the guys did a terrific job in the pits. We lost the clutch there before halfway, and so I was having to get out of the pits and on restarts, try to be careful. It was pretty tough, and then we lost third gear on the restart, so I was having to go from second to fourth. And it's a good race car, good race team, and when you got those things, you do good things. I want to congratulate Jeff Burton. He did a great job. Hey, he was fast all day long. He's been wanting to win a race for a long time. And congratulations to those guys. They did an awesome job.
And the last comments there from Dale, kind of something that became a theme, I think. Here they had one more post-race interview, and this was obviously a pretty popular win with Jeff Burton getting his first win. Bobby Labonte finished third. He led two laps in the race, and Ralph Shaheen was one of the pit reporters. He caught up with him.
Well, Bobby Labonte, you wanted to race your brother at the end of this one, but you did it not for the win, unfortunately. Tell me about the battle.
The Interstate Pontiac, we're decent all day. We just didn't have enough for the top two cars, and at times we didn't have enough for the top 10 cars. It just seemed like just the differences on tires and the racetrack was a little different at times. It made a big difference, but man, I tell you what, you know, I know what Jeff Burton's going through. I won my first one at a big track like this, and everybody needs to win one. I mean, it's great. So congratulations to those guys, and you know, we're lucky we came out with third without a scratch on it. We'll go to Bristol and see what we can do.
There you have Bobby Labonte finishing third in that race, April 6th of 1997. His brother Terry Labonte led a race high 104 laps, finished fourth. Ricky Rudd looked awesome in the Tide ride. He was fifth. Dale Earnhardt finished sixth. Ward Burton was seventh. Sterling Marlin was the last car on the lead lap in eighth. Michael Waltrip ninth. Steve Grissom, a name I know very little about, he finished 10th. Some other notables, Bill Elliott was 11th, two laps down. The late John Andretti finished 12th. One of my all-time favorite NASCAR names, Lake Speed, came home 16th. Mike Spinner led 10 laps in the race, wound up multiple laps down in 22nd. We mentioned Dick Trickle was 23rd. ESPN, I'm sure, noted that on SportsCenter that night. Jeff Gordon led 69 laps, but then he limped home at the end after the wreck. This is still back in the days, of course, where you could run a damaged car as long as you meet minimum speed. Gordon was 30th. Rusty Wallace wrecked out 37th. Mark Martin was 38th. And Darrell Waltrip dead last in 43rd. I complain a lot about the length of races these days when they're 3 hours and 31 minutes and such. Holy cow, 4 hours to run that first race at Texas. 10 cautions for 73 laps, a big reason why. 19 lead changes among 10 drivers. There you have it. And thanks again to our track president, Eddie Gossage, looking back at the 1997 Interstate Batteries 500 at Texas Motor Speedway.
No Limits Nation comes to you from Texas Motor Speedway. Let's find out what's going on at TMS this week.
Hey, this week we've got racing at the virtual Texas Motor Speedway. And, hey, we got e-racing. We got an e-watch and win for you this Sunday with us here at Texas Motor Speedway. So, once again, just like this past Sunday, we've got a huge crew of real NASCAR drivers entering to run an iRacing event here on the virtual Texas Motor Speedway. And Fox and FS1 are both going to be airing it. It's going to start at noon Central Time on Sunday. And you've got a chance to win from us here at Texas Motor Speedway. It's our e-watch and win this Sunday. Every 15 laps during the O'Reilly Auto Parts 125. We're going to post a trivia question. You can follow along the Texas Motor Speedway Twitter and Facebook pages. Submit your entries, your answers to these trivia questions. And then on Monday, we'll randomly pick winners from each one. Prizes could include things like autographed items, racing memorabilia, and more. The prizes are to be announced, but it is this Sunday, noon Central Time on Fox and FS1, the O'Reilly Auto Parts 125. It is part of NASCAR's eNASCAR iRacing Pro Invitational Series, and they're going to keep doing this on Fox and FS1 over the next 6 weeks while we are out of racing because of coronavirus. Watch it this Sunday. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook for your chance to win on our eWatch and Win this Sunday. Remind you that we still are in a postponed mode for the O'Reilly Auto Parts 500 race weekend. It was supposed to be this week. Friday night was supposed to be the Vancourt 350 for trucks. Saturday, the My Bariatric Solutions 300 for Xfinity. Sunday, the Cup race, the O'Reilly Auto Parts 500. Postponed. We're waiting NASCAR to find dates to put everything on because they've got seven races they have to reschedule right now. All tickets previously purchased for the O'Reilly Auto Parts 500 race weekend will be valid for the rescheduled date, or you can return them for a 120% credit to your account to be used at Texas Motor Speedway or any other Speedway Motorsports track the remainder of this year or next year. Go to TexasMotorSpeedway.com for details, or if you really aren't sure, call our ticket office. We do have operators who are working from home and answering your calls, 817-215-8500. And just a reminder, our track, Texas Motor Speedway, is closed to the public right now. Closed till April 17th is the latest word we have from Speedway Motorsports. Any questions, call again our ticket office at 817-215-8500. But be sure you're watching for your chance to win with our eWatch and Win this Sunday during the O'Reilly Auto Parts 125.
I'm Christopher Bell, and this is No Limits Nation.
Let's get to some news from the garage to wrap up this edition of No Limits Nation presented by Ashley Home Store. Told you at the top of the show about this, but the Indy 500 has been rescheduled now for August 23rd because of COVID-19. The Indy 500, the 104th edition, will be on NBC. It was supposed to be coming up on May 24th, and you know, it's usually the biggest day in auto racing with the Monaco Grand Prix in the morning, followed by the Indy 500, the Coca-Cola 600. As of right now, the Coke 600 is the only one remaining on the schedule, as NASCAR's not postponed anything beyond May 3rd. IndyCar also has announced that the GMR Grand Prix at Indianapolis is going to be on July 4th, and we're going to have a NASCAR-IndyCar doubleheader that week. So on Saturday, July 4th, the first race of the day at Indianapolis is going to be the GMR Grand Prix for the IndyCars on the road course. That'll be followed by the Xfinity Series running on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course for the first time ever, the Pennzoil 150 at the Brickyard. And then on Sunday, July 5th, will be the Brickyard 400 for the Cup Series. It'll be the first ever weekend in which IndyCar and NASCAR have run the same track the same weekend. Of course, the IndyCar is not running the Oval that weekend, running the road course, but that'll be a huge July 4th weekend at Indianapolis. And again, August 23rd is when the Indy 500 has been moved back to. That is a Sunday. They'll do a full 2 weeks there. They've had to kind of shuffle their scheduling a little bit because they had some other races impacted by this move with the Indy 500. And so Mid-Ohio has been moved a little bit earlier, and then Worldwide Technology Raceway at Gateway bumped back to August 30th. Also, IndyCar has at least one of their races that's been postponed that they are planning to still run, and that was the season opener in the streets of St. Petersburg. They currently listed that as the season finale on a date to be determined that they're going to run in the streets of St. Petersburg. A pretty popular move, I think, with the drivers because they really do love that street course in St. Petersburg, Florida. Also, not to be outdone by NASCAR, IndyCar is getting into iRacing starting this weekend. It'll be the the inaugural IndyCar iRacing Challenge this Saturday, 3 o'clock Central Time is when this will be done. 25 drivers already on the entry list, pretty much the whole field from the IndyCar series. Also, a few special guests are slated to be announced Friday morning, as well as the venue. Doing the show here on Thursday, Friday morning, they will announce the final winner for the venue for the first race. It was down to Watkins Glen and Michigan International Speedway in the online voting heading into Thursday afternoon. Again, it'll be a 3 o'clock start for the inaugural IndyCar iRacing Challenge. You can see it on IndyCar.com, on IndyCar's YouTube channel and Facebook, as well as Twitch from iRacing, which I watched a virtual race on a couple of weeks ago. This is the first of a 6-event series that will be held through May 2nd for the IndyCar Series. NASCAR teams are being impacted by stay-at-home orders. I'm going to probably botch the pronunciation of this county, but Cabarrus County in North Carolina, the second one that's home to NASCAR teams, it's issued orders for residents to stay at home all the way through April 16th. The other was Mecklenburg County. Cabarrus County has teams that have locations there. Stuart Haas Racing, Chip Ganassi Racing, Roush Fenway, Levine Family, and JTG Doherty. And then Joe Gibbs Racing is in Mecklenburg County, as well as Hendrick Motorsports. Mecklenburg County also has a stay-at-home order through Thursday, April 16th. And this is the reason why I was shocked they were going to try to run the Atlanta weekend whatsoever that then got postponed on that Friday 2 weeks ago. NASCAR did notify teams that an employee, this is a NASCAR employee, who was at Atlanta Motor Speedway that day, tested positive for coronavirus. Multiple teams confirmed they had received that notification. NASCAR had no further comment. They did not identify who it was either because of privacy laws, but did confirm that an employee who was present during that Atlanta event that basically had one day of nothing going on Friday at the track did test positive for coronavirus. Man, I know it's tough on all of us. It's stopping us all down right now. But I do invite you to watch the NASCAR Pro Invitational at Texas on Sunday. It is the O'Reilly Auto Parts 125. It'll be noon Central Time on Fox and on FS1. And next Tuesday on the show, I'm going to recap our virtual race. I will virtually recap our virtual race from Texas Motor Speedway. Hey, this is the official podcast of Texas Motor Speedway. It's No Limits Nation, presented by Ashley Homestore. Hope I can help you kill a little bit of the downtime you have while you're stuck at home during this coronavirus pandemic, and we'll try to get through it together. Please subscribe, download, listen, and tell a friend about the official podcast of Texas Motor Speedway.
This has been No Limits Nation, produced and hosted by Rich Phillips, the voice of Texas Motor Speedway. Take a moment and subscribe via Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, and more. And check out TexasMotorSpeedway.com for info and tickets to all events at your home track.